From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. President Trump wasn't initially scheduled to speak at the Republican National Convention today in Charlotte, North Carolina, but he flew in and spoke before a small and dedicated crowd of delegates who gathered in person to nominate him as their presidential candidate for a second time. And the delegates cheered on as he gave an impromptu speech that lasted for more than an hour. Let's listen to a little.
We've accomplished more than just about any administration in the history of our country. We've secured our borders. We've built our wall, which will be finished very shortly. We've brought back manufacturing jobs.
There's a lot to discuss here. Let's bring in NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving for more. And Ron, President Trump began his remarks by, again, casting doubt on the security of mail-in ballots. Then he moved on to praise the stock market, the economy, his response to the coronavirus. What are your thoughts about what you heard?
It was very much as though we were still in February right now and the coronavirus had never happened. 176,000 deaths had never happened. The president said they were mostly old and sick people. It was very much as though the recession had never happened and was not still happening. Very much as though the death of George Floyd, death of Breonna Taylor had not happened. The president was in the mode of what if we just go back to February? And at times he actually literally said to the crowd, think about your life the way it was back in February.
Mm-hmm. He also leveled a lot of unfounded accusations at Democrats. Let's listen.
What they're doing is using COVID to steal an election.
Right.
They're using COVID to defraud the American people, all of our people, of a fair and free election. And we can't do that.
Ron, this isn't the only questionable or false claim the president made about his opponents. This is a regular tactic the president uses. He throws out a lot of details that Democrats then have to go on the defense about.
That's right. The tell here is those other voices you're hearing while the president is talking. It's almost as though he had a chorus behind him or a choir behind him. And these are sounds coming from the delegates, people who were brought from around the country as the heads of the delegations coming to vote for him to be renominated. There are about 300 in the hall, and they are very well mic'd, so that even if you're listening on the radio and you can't see them because the coverage is kind of limited, you get the impression that he is speaking to a highly enthusiastic group of people who believe everything that he says, and they are not going to question any of it. But of course, as you suggest, sentence after sentence, paragraph after paragraph included assertions such as saying that the wall was about to be finished and things of that nature that even casual observers know are not the case.
You know, this is the first time we'll hear that we actually heard from the president this week, but he's also making an appearance every day. That's more than any sitting Republican president has done before. How has Trump reshaped this event?
It's hard to think of any president who has shown up more than once or twice at his own convention. In fact, it used to be considered poor form to come at all until the very last night to accept, and then, of course, with great reluctance and humility, the nomination of the party. But look, Donald Trump has reshaped this party in his own image. He did it in Cleveland in 2016, but at that point, you still had some other party stars and rivals who were contesting for airtime. Not this year. Everyone speaking is either named Trump or they are established acolytes, people in his orbit. And some of them are political pros, and some of them are previously unknown citizens who will testify about what Donald Trump's presidency has done for them and meant for them.
Yeah, and the RNC is not going to be an all-virtual event like the Democratic National Convention. With a little bit of time that I have with you, how will this look for viewers who are watching this on television?
It will look like a mix. It will look a little bit like today in the sense that you'll see a lot of the president, we'll see a lot of his people. Their faces will be up close and in the frame. And we will then see some crowd shots if they're doing some of these events in the Mellon Auditorium, which is in the Commerce Department building. It's a beautiful auditorium and dates back decades, generations. And it's a big space where they'll have a lot of enthusiastic Republicans, people from the administration and supporters of the president to give at that rally feeling.
Yeah. That's NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Thank you.
Thank you, Tonya.
And just a day before the convention, President Trump made news, saying yesterday that the FDA has issued an emergency authorization for a COVID-19 treatment known as convalescent plasma. Patients are already enrolled in studies to see whether blood plasma from patients who've recovered from COVID-19 can help fight the disease in other people. President Trump had accused the FDA of delaying approval for political reasons, but then yesterday he said the treatment could be expanded. Meanwhile, the head of the Infectious Disease Society of America says good scientific data is still lacking. Let's bring in Rochelle Walensky. She's chief of infectious diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Walensky, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
And start by telling us, is this emergency use authorization for plasma a good call? Because we remember that there was also one for hydroxychloroquine, another treatment that was touted by the president, and that one was later revoked.
Right. This is an important question. I think so far we have two known treatments for COVID-19. One is dexamethasone, which showed a mortality difference. The second is remdesivir, which showed a decrease in duration of disease. This treatment, convalescent plasma, I do believe holds promise. What happened is on August 12th, there was a pre-publication that has not yet been peer-reviewed that was posted to MedArchive, where they're posted, and it showed data from 35,000 patients who received convalescent plasma. And these data demonstrated that if you got convalescent plasma earlier in your course rather than later in your course, you tended to do better. If you got plasma that had more antibody compared to less antibody, you tended to do better. But it was a cohort study, not a clinical trial, and that's usually the evidence that we rely upon for FDA authorization. I will remind everybody that when hydroxychloroquine received FDA emergency use authorization, we were in a similar boat, that there were cohort data suggesting it might work, but we were still waiting for the clinical trial data, and the clinical trial data for hydroxychloroquine actually demonstrated it might do more harm than good, and that the EUA was rescinded. So here we are again. I do think that convalescent plasma has more promise than hydroxychloroquine, but we don't have the data that we as experts like to see, randomized controlled trials, in order to move these things forward.
We'll talk more about the science in just a minute, but first tell me more of, you know, why you're optimistic that this could be a good treatment and you know, remind us what it is exactly, how it works.
So if you can take antibody from people who have had documented COVID, and you can give that antibody after it's been processed to somebody who is in the process of getting COVID or getting sick with COVID, one could imagine that somebody else's antibody against COVID would help you in that process of clinically improving until your body can make its own antibody. And if you can give it earlier in the disease course, we believe that you might be able to prevent getting you to more severe disease. And it's worked in other viruses. It's worked in influenza before. So we have reason to think it might work. We have reason to believe that earlier is better than later. That's what these data showed. We have reason to believe that more antibody is better than less. That's also what these data showed. But we don't have any evidence yet for COVID-19 of if you got the antibody, this is how you did, versus if you didn't get the antibody, this is how you did, or the plasma.
There have already been about 70,000 people who've been treated with this serum as part of various studies. How does this authorization from the FDA, you know, change what doctors are doing right now? Do you expect more to go out there and start using this?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. So through expanded access programs, more than 70,000 people have gotten this, more than 10,000 physicians have prescribed it, and more than 2,800 facilities. So you can get it if you wanted to get convalescent plasma. There's a layer of paperwork. It's contacting the investigators. There's a reasonable number of hurdles in order to do so. I think the big concern here is that if it's emergency use authorized, then people could get it much easier. And on the one hand, that's good. But on the other hand, if you can get it, you may be less likely to enroll in the clinical trial that will give us the evidence, the foolproof evidence that we need to demonstrate its pure efficacy and its safety.
Because the science is not totally clear yet, I mean, is there any chance that using plasma is somehow unsafe, that it could hurt people?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. And this preprint actually did not spend a lot of time or energy talking about the side effects, the adverse events of getting convalescent plasma. In general, convalescent plasma is thought to be quite safe. However, you can get transfusion-related reactions. You can get other adverse events. And in the first 20,000 people that were reported in the emergency access program, the expanded access program, I should say, the first 20,000, there were 13 deaths that were thought to be related to the transfusion. Now, that's a very small percentage, just less than 0.1%. But it does speak to the fact that we also need to see the safety data and the adverse event data.
That's Dr. Rochelle Walensky, head of infectious disease at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Walensky, thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Should I attend that barbecue at my friend's house? What about a picnic in a park or an outdoor concert? These are all questions we're asking ourselves right now. And while some experts are calling for new quarantine measures, the reality we are living in is one of decisions, many times based on our gut or instincts. Researchers, however, at Georgia Tech have now created a tool that can actually help us make more rational, data-based decisions based on where we live. And we're joined now by one of the creators of the map, Joshua Weitz, a professor of biological sciences at Georgia Tech. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I have the map open right now, and I see
Sure. The
United States is mostly red and orange to signify the high risk level. And in Los Angeles County, where I am, it says that I have a 96% risk level, and that's for a gathering of 100 people. Can you break that down for me? How do I make sense of this as I weigh my decisions? What does 96% risk mean?
Right. So what we're trying to do is estimate the probability or chance that one or more individuals in a gathering of a certain size may have COVID-19. And we can get in and unpack how we get to that conclusion. There are certain assumptions we make. But in essence, what we're doing is taking recent reported cases from state and county health departments throughout the United States, which are then aggregated by the New York Times at the county level. And again, we're looking at recent cases, those that happened mm-hmm. the last 10 to 14 days approximately, as a proxy for the potential that individuals may be out and about circulating and given asymptomatic fractions may be unaware that they're sick. Mm-hmm. But we have to have some assumptions. So you've probably noticed there's a little button that says ascertainment bias. How many
yes.
cases are being reported for versus how many are really out there? So for every case that's reported, there may be 5 or even 10-fold as many actual cases. But we're taking those recent cases with this ascertainment bias and then doing the math, and we can get into that too, of how we go from that to this probability that if you were in a gathering of 100 folks, that one or more might be infected.
But then when I'm looking at this 96% risk level for where I am for a gathering of 100 people, I mean, even if that goes down a few numbers or up to 100, the risk is still very high.
The reality is that we're at a period of time, if you look at this map, that there are places in the country with high community transmission levels. And those high community transmission levels mean that when you are in a larger group, that there's a significantly elevated chance. And you're right, whether we're off a little bit on the ascertainment bias or not, these levels are significant, right? And my hope would be that then this lets people understand the need to wear a mask, reconsider whether they should be in an indoor setting for that long, reconsider the format of an event that they may be planning, or find some other way to interact. So it's crucial to understand that this is not the chance that you're going to get COVID-19. In fact, we're trying to communicate the risks associated with being in large gatherings precisely to help people reduce their risk of contracting the disease.
Joshua Weitz is a professor of biological sciences at Georgia Tech and one of the creators of a risk assessment map that shows you how likely you are to be around someone with COVID-19. We'll link that to you at hereandnow.org. Well, tools like his can help you evaluate risk and make decisions, but our next guest says all of this isn't so simple. Joining us now is David Ropeek. He's the author of How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. And he says every time we make a calculation about risk, we're relying on our feelings as much as facts.
To really understand how we do this, though, it's worth stepping back a minute and working from the definition of the word risk itself, which most dictionaries say is something like the chance of something bad happening. So chance is the statistics, like the tools that you've been talking about. But that's only half the definition. The other part is bad, and how bad something feels to you is inescapably subjective. So no matter how much information we have from wonderful tools, we're still going to apply to them our life circumstances, you know, our health and wealth and circumstances and so forth. And our feelings, more than the facts, are what's going to drive our choices.
Right. It's subjective. You know, we talk a lot about whether states should declare stay-at-home orders, but way back in March, we saw a lot of people stopped moving around way before states gave them stay-at-home orders. How much do rules and regulations really influence our behavior here?
So rules and regulations are one input. So to somebody who follows the rules, they're going to lead to one choice. To somebody who doesn't like rules imposed on them, they're going to lead to a different choice. That's a feeling about how it feels to have rules imposed on you. That's a perfect example. And another one, Tonya, is that in March, we were all freaked out and staying home, and now we're going out and about. What's changed is the risk isn't as new as it was. When a risk is new, it's scarier because we don't understand it as well. And also, we like to have control over our lives, being able to go about our business, getting our hair cut and our tattoos and going to NASCAR races. And now we want that back. So that's competing against the fear of the disease. And you can see, I could go on, but this is all about our feelings, not just what the risk tools tell us.
Our feelings, but then also culturally as Americans. I mean, we see in other parts of the world, people are able to bring down the numbers of COVID-19 cases because they are following rules and regulations. We as Americans kind of have this independence that might be hindering us during all of this.
Yeah, so remember I said at the beginning that how we feel about any risk, COVID or whatever, is a matter of our life circumstances. So in any culture, that culture is going to have a voice. But it's an important point you raise. So the people who aren't wearing masks, they're getting a lot of attention in the media. But if you look past the headlines, most people do wear the masks. And that's because we all share around the world something called social altruism, which means that I will sacrifice some of my liberty, freedom, resources, whatever you want, in the name of the greater common good, so that the world works that way, so that other people are doing the same thing to protect me. When we're all afraid of the same thing at the same time, like this, we come together and do sacrifice, and most people are.
David, how big of a hurdle is it to the human brain that COVID-19 is pretty invisible? I mean, of course, we don't see the transmit, but most of us also don't see what's going on in these hospitals that have been overwhelmed. Is there something here about it being out of sight, out of mind for us?
Well, yeah, there is to some degree. But what's happening now in America as the virus finds more and more and more naive DNA to infect, more and more and more people are, in fact, encountering people they know who are sick or who have died. So when a risk is personified, when the risk has a face and a name, especially one you know, it does have much more power than when it's anonymous. And the higher our awareness is, the brighter the blip is on our fear radar screen. And I would say COVID's got a pretty bright blip going right now.
Yeah. I want to run a couple of scenarios by you. So many people, especially young people, are running into situations where they'll go to visit their parents, but they'll try to stay socially distant. And their parents will say, come on in. It's all right. Just come in the house. You know, it's like they assume that their kid is less likely to be contagious than a stranger. I know that goes back to what you were saying about feelings, but we know that that's not necessarily the case. Like, we sometimes think about the people we know as like, well, they are less at risk potentially for having COVID-19.
So the word here is trust. Family, friends, whoever it is that you trust, you will be less afraid of. That, by the way, also pertains to who's doing the communicating about COVID. So if the person telling you to wear the mask is someone you trust, or the person who's telling you, hey, you don't really have to wear the mask, go shopping, is telling you that. If you trust them, that information will have more influence. There have been outstanding examples of trustworthy risk communication and outstanding examples of poor risk communication. And the one defining factor in all of them is, does the person sound like they're really on my side?
Another scenario to run by you. So what about obsessive cleaning? This is something that we talk about so much on our show. We talk about schools and businesses and people bragging about how much they clean their surfaces, but the virus primarily spreads through the air. So what's up with that? Is this kind of like our desire to do something?
Yes, and you've hit on a brilliant core issue throughout any risk, but this one in particular. We feel less safe, the less control we have. Let me use a metaphor. Imagine you're driving a car. Now close your eyes, but keep driving. That's a lack of control. So now transfer this to a disease you can't see and you don't understand, and where all the scientists are saying they don't understand it. That is a feeling of, I don't know what I need to know to protect myself. That's powerlessness. And we'll do all sorts of things like obsessive cleaning, like buying toilet paper, like buying guns, to give ourselves a sense of control, which gives us a sense of greater safety. And when we don't have it, we reach out for any way to get it, that sense of control.
David Ropeek, author of How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tanya. Be well.
Details are now emerging in the shooting of Jacob Blake, a black man who was shot multiple times in the back by police last night in Kenosha, Wisconsin. In a bystander's video, Blake is seen walking toward his car before an officer opens fire while Blake has his back turned to him. The officers involved have been placed on leave. Meanwhile, the shooting prompted widespread protests in the city last night. For more, let's bring in LaToya Dennis with Milwaukee Public Radio, WUWM. Welcome.
Thank you.
And as far as we can tell from that video, what happened just before police shot Jacob Blake? What do we know?
You know, it's been said that Jacob Blake was on the scene because there were two women who were involved in a verbal altercation. Now, bystanders said that he was trying to break that up, and we didn't see that on video. What we do see is police are on the scene. Blake walks around his vehicle to the driver's side door, opens it, and he appears to try and get in. A police officer grabs the back of his shirt and then begins to fire. That police officer fired about 7 shots. When Blake was shot, it's been said by his fiance that his 3 children were in the vehicle, and so they watched this happen. The civil rights attorney, Ben Crump, has verified this.
And the reaction is pretty swift, because soon afterward, people start to gather at the scene. Protests begin that go on for hours. What happens next?
Absolutely. You know, people gathered at that scene, 60 to 100 people, maybe more. And they marched to basically City Hall, which is where the county courthouse is. And it's where the police administration building is. And by the time they got there, there were already, you know, roadblocks that were put up to try and keep people from getting too close to the buildings. Many of those trucks were set on fire, windows were broken, and there was a lot of damage that was done. And protesters were met by police in riot gear, who at some point, several times throughout the night, did fire tear gas into the crowd and rubber bullets.
Of course, this is very reminiscent to protests that we've seen throughout the country over the last couple of months. And the governor there, Tony Evers, a Democrat, weighed in on this shooting. He condemned it, even though he also acknowledged in a tweet that all the details of the case are not yet known. What more can you tell us about what the governor is saying today and what the political reaction has been?
You know, some people have said that we don't have all the details and that the governor shouldn't yet be speaking on this whatsoever. But from the community has said you know, that some of them are applauding the governor for his stance of saying, you know, Black lives do matter and that we shouldn't see this sort of violence from police officers. But I think most people just want to see justice. And when they say justice, especially the people who are out there protesting, they want to see the officer not only fired, but they want to see him charged and they want to see him, you know, go to prison.
And just briefly, what does happen next with the investigation?
So right now, the State Department of Justice is investigating this, and they say that they strive to have a report to prosecution within 30 days. And then from there, it's up to, you know, the prosecutors as to how long they take to make public their decision.
All right. I'm sure we'll be in touch as that process plays out. LaToya Dennis with Milwaukee Public Radio, WUWM. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
The devastating blow of the pandemic on the U.S. economy is starting to come into focus. Many states have moratoriums on evictions and utility shutoffs that are set to expire next week. But even before those protections phase out, people are seeing their electricity or gas service cut off because of unpaid bills. And one of them we're going to hear from now. Stacy Mason is with us from Marion, Ohio. Stacy, welcome.
Hello.
And I hear that your gas is back on now, but that it was cut off about a week ago. What was that like for you?
Oh, it was terrible. I had to boil hot water to make, you know, bathtub water for me and my children. And I had to heat up water on the oven just to be able to wash my dishes. It was really bad.
Were you behind on your bills? I assume you were.
Yes, I was. I had got laid off back in March due to the COVID. And all my bills started piling up and I wasn't able to get them under control.
So what happened exactly? Because I understand that Ohio, I mean, there's supposed to be a moratorium on utility shutoffs like your gas company. So like, what happened? Was this a mistake? Yeah.
No, it wasn't. They said that they could extend it for a week. And I told them that I was still laid off and I wouldn't be able to make the payment. So they knew what my situation was and they still came and they shut it off. They didn't knock on the door to let me know beforehand or anything. They just left a paper in my door and shut my gas services off.
But you had been in touch with them. You'd been trying to work something out?
Yes, I had been.
So how'd you cope? How did you deal without having that gas for the few days that it was off?
Well, the first day I cried a lot because I didn't know what I was going to do. And then I decided to reach out to our local community action center and see if there was any help that they could offer me. And luckily, by the grace of God, I spoke with Tracy, who has been a godsend for me.
And you're referring to Tracy Rector. She's the director of that group. We're going to hear from her in just a minute. But had you ever had to rely on someone else or a group like that before to help you out of a tough situation?
Years ago, I did reach out to them, but it has been several years because I've been working and able to take care of things on my own. So I was a little embarrassed to have to reach out for help, but I didn't have a choice because I do have children in the home.
How many kids?
I have two. And they are 15 and 17.
And how are they doing with all this?
They were both upset, you know, because they weren't able to shower. And, you know, I had to heat up the water, like I said, just for them to be able to take a small bath. So they were upset, you know, and didn't understand why I couldn't pay the bill. You know, they knew that I wasn't working. But, you know, kids, they don't really understand how hard it is to take care of everything in your home, you know.
Yeah, well, tell me more about how the pandemic has affected you. You said you lost your job. It was at an auto plant there in Ohio. You were able to get by on unemployment for a little bit, and that extra bump that the federal government had provided, which has now expired. Tell me more about how you're doing economically.
Oh, well, I'm struggling really bad now. I'm still laid off. I went back to work for about 2 weeks, and then I got laid off again, and now my unemployment isn't going through. So now I don't have any income coming in at all.
So what does that mean? I mean, I'm sure you have more bills piling up and the prospect of the electricity getting shut off or something else.
Yes, I do. And my rent's coming up due on the 1st, and that's $800. And I'm hoping that Tracy is able to help me out with my rent. If she can't help me, then I'm probably going to end up getting evicted.
You know, the terrible thing about this pandemic is that there's a whole group of people just like you who work go to work every day, who have lost their jobs. And then there's another group of people who seem to be, still be doing okay, that can't even imagine what it would be like to have their power shut off. I mean, what's your message to people who look at this crisis that we're in and say, well, hasn't really affected me yet?
Well, they should be very grateful. It hasn't affected them. You know, you could lose everything in the blink of an eye. You get laid off and then everything, all your bills start piling up. You can't pay for gas or food or even pay your mortgage or your rent.
Hmm.
And it can happen in the blink of an eye.
Stacey Mason in Marion, Ohio, good luck to you. I'm sorry for the trouble
you've had. Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right, we are going to turn now to Tracy Rector. She is the center director of the Ohio Heartland Community Action Commission. It is the group that helps Stacey get her gas turned back on. Tracy, are you there?
I am.
Welcome. Tell me, what did you hear there? Is Stacey's story a one-off, or is that common across the state of Ohio?
We are hearing a lot of that. Our phone, simply does not stop ringing, and a lot of people who have come to us for the first time. And like Stacey said, they do admit that they're embarrassed. You know, they've never had to ask for help. They don't even know what to do or how or where to reach out. We just try to ease their fears. You know, everybody here has been through it. We understand it. You're not alone. Where can we help? What's your immediate need? Where Stacey's was the gas. So we dealt with that first. And then we were able to, I could help her through what else is going on. You know, can we also help with the electric? Can I help with your rent? Do you need gasoline for the car to get back and forth to doctor's appointments? Soon the kids will be going to school. You know, we just want to try to surround the whole entire family and see what it is that we can do until her unemployment gets through and until she can just simply sit on the phone for hours and wait for them to answer her as to why it hasn't started back up again.
And how does this work? Are you directly making payments to the utilities, or are you giving cash infusions?
No, everything always goes directly to either the landlords or the utility companies. We don't ever give a client money themselves. We have a different phone line to call in with the utility companies than the customer does. And so they can go through everything with us and look at the past history, when they've paid last, how far behind they are. A lot of our individuals we put on a PIP program, which is a percentage of income payment plan. So it just depends on what their situation is. I had a gentleman call in the other day who needed help with a car payment. I said, I can't do a car payment, but tell me what's happening. He said, I have to keep the car to keep my job. I said, let me pay your rent for you. Then you can pay your car payment. So we just really try to listen and see what it is we can. If we can't do it, is there another resource in our community who can? Or what can we do to, connect dots and make it happen for folks?
Can you help me understand why this is happening, though? I was under the impression that utilities weren't really yet allowed to start turning people's gas and power off.
Well, actually, they're not. When I did call the utility company, the representative I got was a seasonal representative, so I was very grateful for that. And she immediately said, I don't know why this happened. This is a mistake. She should not have been turned off. Let me put you on hold and find somebody. She indicated to me that with their August billing, that they would now begin to see the disconnects that then could happen in September.
Right. So how concerned are you about the next several weeks when these shutoff bans do start to expire in earnest?
Oh, very concerned. We've helped a lot of folks with our summer crisis program going on right now. We have been able to help a lot of folks with their electric. That's not something we have money for right now for the gas. You know, there's four of us in the office and there's a whole lot of folks who are in need. So we just do the best we can and get them back on as quickly as we can.
Much worse in the last couple of months than pre-COVID, I imagine?
Definitely a lot worse in the rent department, because the moratorium was on for the utilities as well as the rent. The rent moratorium dropped off a couple months ago, and so that has been real busy. But I do anticipate seeing a lot with the utility companies, especially if we have not already helped them through our PIP and HEAT programs.
Do you get the feeling then that we haven't really fully experienced the brunt of this economic crisis yet?
I think it's just now coming, because that additional $600 a week has stopped. So they're going to start to feel a little bit more of a crunch. And if they can't get back to work soon or find a different job to get back to work, because I know here in our community, several companies, restaurants, different things have just simply closed, and their people are never going to go back to work at that location. So that is scary for everybody.
Tracy Richter is Center Director of the Ohio Heartland Community Action Commission, a group that's helping people pay their bills during the pandemic. Tracy, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Tracy and Stacy, thank you. I don't know if Stacy is still on the line, but...
I'm still here. I'm just very grateful for the help that Tracy has provided, and she definitely didn't make me feel embarrassed. On my own, I was a little embarrassed, but she really put me at ease, and she's a wonderful woman, and I just want to thank her again.
Oh, bless you, Stacy. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
A glimmer of hope in a tough time.
The pandemic has changed the way we work, interact, and for many, where we live. In places like New York City, the population is decreasing, and home values are going down in what were once hot real estate markets like San Francisco. So what does this mean for the future of U.S. cities? Derek Thompson is staff writer at The Atlantic, and he joins us now from Washington, as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
So, Derek, we heard early on in the pandemic about an urban exodus, or rather people leaving cities like New York for rural areas. Does this decrease mean people aren't coming back to those major cities?
As with so many things in this pandemic, this is an acceleration of pre-existing trends rather than some invented new thing that just started in 2020. Already for the last few decades, you saw domestic migration. That means a number of Americans moving in and out of cities decreasing. People were leaving cities more than they were going into cities. And the reason why metro populations were rising in places like LA and New York was because of the immigrant population. So right now you have a lot less immigration. You have continued out-migration, and that means that cities are shrinking, and they already were shrinking in 2019. The pandemic has accelerated this process. It's made a lot of people who might have been on the edge, at the margins, thinking maybe I should get out of the West Village, maybe I should get out of West Hollywood, making that move and leaving downtown areas. And it's leading a lot of people to be a little bit pessimistic about cities in terms of their population, their tax revenue, and their culture in the near future. I think those fears are well-founded and empirical in nature.
Do you have a sense of the demographics of those leaving? Race, age, class, etc.?
Yeah. So on race first, in the 20th century, you saw something called the Great Migration. That was, say, between 1900 and 1960, millions of Black families leaving the South and going into urban areas in the North, Chicago, Philadelphia. They were escaping Jim Crow, and they were entering cities in the North and Midwest. Now you're starting to see something that sociologists call the reverse Great Migration. They are leaving cities in the North and Midwest, and they are moving South. The truth is that the vast majority of Americans are doing the same. They are leaving expensive cities on the coast, and the places they tend to be moving to are in the South and West, in the Sun Belt, in the Carolinas, and even in Idaho. What we also know about the people leaving cities is that they tend to be millennials. People in their late 20s and early 30s are up to three times more likely to move than any other age group. As a result, if you're going to have a period of migration, whatever it is, it's likely that young working adults will be leading that charge.
I want to ask you more about the implications of all of this, but we've heard this framed as the death of New York City when we're talking specifically about what is one of our largest cities in the country. What's really at stake here with this decline in population?
What's at stake is everything that cities are so praised and cherished for: culture, economics, politics. I have equated what's happening in places like New York and Los Angeles to a forest fire. On the one hand, forest fires destroy everything in their path, and then new growth pushes through the dirt and the ash, and you have potentially a more diverse forest that grows after. I think the same thing could happen in America's cities right now, that you could be looking at a year of really difficult economics, but I'm optimistic about cities the next 5 or 10 years. The really interesting stuff, though, is when you start to think about the political implications of coastal cities in long-term decline and Sunbelt cities in long-term growth. The fastest-growing cities in America are not Los Angeles, New York. They're Phoenix and Austin and Dallas and Houston. And the political aspect here means that overall, you have less migration to blue metros in blue states and more migration to blue metros in red states, meaning that all of those states around the South and the Southwest that in 2016 voted for President Trump, over the next 10 years, we could look at them as potential purple states or even as light blue states. Joe Biden is leading in Arizona right now.
You touched on this already. You said we're already seeing changes with this election, but in 5 or 10 years, we will see even more of a change or shift. Do you think that that will be a major change that we'll see and shift when we think about November's presidential election?
I think in many ways, both the pandemic and Donald Trump are pulling forward the future. Trump, in many ways, accelerated the GOP's relationship with the white working class in the Great Lakes regions when he won Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan. And he also loosened the connection between Republicans and metros. Democrats are winning in Maricopa County, which is Phoenix. They're running up huge margins in the 4 major cities in Texas. So I think what's happening here is you could tell the story as sort of a resorting of the strongest cities in America, that the Democratic Party in particular is not necessarily going to be commanded by San Francisco and New York in the next decade or 2 decades. It will be led by Phoenix and Austin and Dallas and Houston and Atlanta, a very different picture of the Democratic Party of the next generation.
Derek Thompson is a staff writer with The Atlantic. As always, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.